a reverent perseverance that depends on God's power, and a unity that refuses grumbling, a witness that shines in a dark world, and two living examples, Timothy and Epaphroditus, who embody the same gospel shape, self-forgetfulness. So as we read, we're in chapter 2, finishing it up. We're going to be doing 12, verses 12 through 30. And again, 3 points. Verses 12 through 18, worked out salvation. Warm-hearted servanthood, Timothy, verses 19 through 20, and willing to risk servanthood, Epaphroditus, verses 25 through 30. So let's begin verses 12 through 18. Paul says, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me." So look at with me at the opening words in verse 12, which says, "So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed." Those first two words, "so then," or "therefore," are Paul's way of fastening this new paragraph to everything that he has just said. So he's not changing subjects. He's drawing a straight line from Christ's story to the church's life. And what has he just set before us? So recall the great gospel hymn of Christ that we talked about last Sunday. The hymn of Christ's humility and exaltation in verses 5 through 11. A key word from that hymn reappears here in verse 12. In verse 8, Christ humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. Now Paul turns to the Philippians and says, "So then, just as you have always obeyed, work out your salvation with fear and trembling." And that repetition is deliberate. Paul is anchoring their obedience in Christ's obedience, showing that what he calls for is not a self-salvation, but gospel-shaped faithfulness that flows from the belonging to the obedient Son. So Paul is saying, in view of the Lord's perfect humility and obedience that held steady under the most extreme pressure, and in view of the Father's vindication and exaltation of his Son, presses on the same posture. The "therefore," verse 12, is the bridge of adoration to imitation. From worshiping Christ's descent to walking in humility and steadfastness, his grace produces in his people. And he speaks with a pastoral warmth here. He says, "My beloved." And he's not driving them with harsh demands. He is gently shepherding them forward with the kind of encouragement that strengthens weary hearts. The Christ who stooped for you is the Christ who now steadies you, so that obedience becomes the lived response of a church learning to think and walk in Christ. So now look carefully at verse 13. Notice the little word that begins the sentence. "For." See, that conjunction matters. Paul's "for" gives us the ground. It explains how he can possibly say what he has just commanded in verse 12. So in 2:13 he writes, "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. See, Paul is not canceling human responsibility. He has just given us a clear, weighty command. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So, but now he pulls back the curtain and shows us what is happening underneath that obedience. He's saying, in effect, let me tell you why this is even possible. So behind your working stands God working. See, you are not left to grind this out alone or on your own. As though you were stranded on an island running an individual race with no help and no hope. The one at work in you, Paul says, is God himself. And notice how specific he is. God is at work in you both to will and to work. So in other words, he is the one shaping your desires and strengthening your actions. You see, he grants the will and he supplies the power so that your obedience is real. Your effort is required, but the ultimate source and sufficiently are entirely his. So the exhortation to work out your own salvation, to work out one's salvation with fear and trembling, is left to stand on its own. I'm sorry, if left to stand on its own, would indeed be a word of condemnation to the Philippians, not a word of encouragement to continue living in a way consistent with the gospel, which results from embracing the attitude of Jesus. But this exhortation to work out our salvation does not stand alone. It comes in a particular context. You see, the Philippians are to stand firm in Paul's absence. And it's followed by a reminder that salvation is God's work within us, in the sense that the desires to work out our salvation and the fear of God is a fruit of his work already began in us, or within us. So as John Calvin wisely remind us, there is a will or desire to do something which we may have, and the power to do these things which we do not have. Therefore, we must have nothing to boast about. But as Calvin adds, a good will is accomplished in us entirely by God and God alone. So Paul now turns to what that obedience looks like in the ordinary and often difficult rhythms of life. Look with me at verse 14. He says, do all things without grumbling or disputing. So Paul goes straight for the tongue and beneath that for the heart. The language deliberately echoes Israel's wilderness story, where grumbling and complaining became their hallmark theme of unbelief. So instead of trusting the God who had redeemed them from Egypt, the people murmured against him and against his appointed servants. So Paul does not want the Philippian church, so rich in gospel privilege, to repeat Israel's pattern of complaint. So one commentator notes that Paul is not addressing some minor irritations, but the kind of chronic discontent and relational friction that can quietly hollow out a congregation's joy and unity. So verse 15 gives the purpose. That you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. So Paul is echoing here Deuteronomy 32, where Moses describes Israel's unfaithfulness as that of a crooked and twisted generation. Only here Paul applies that the phrase to the surrounding world and calls the Philippians to live as faithful children of God in its midst. So the contrast is stark. A grumbling, twisted world on one side, a grateful, blameless people on the other. And it's precisely in that contrast that their witness shines, among whom you shine as lights in the world. And that imagery draws from Daniel 12:3, where the wise shine like the brightness of the sky and like the stars forever and ever. See, the Philippian believers are to be like that, points of steady, quiet light in a dark sky, not because they are impressive in themselves, but because the God who works in them is displaying His character through their conduct. So verse 16 shows what makes that light truly distinct, which says, holding fast or holding forth the word of life. So this phrase can mean both clinging to the gospel and offering it to others, and in context, both of these ideas fit. See, the church shines as it refuses to let go of the world that gave it life and extends that life-giving word to a watching world. As Dennis Johnson puts it, believers shine not by drawing attention to themselves, but by holding out the gospel as a lamp in the darkness, so that their integrity and their message reinforce one another. For Paul, you see, this has deeply personal dimension here. He longs to be able to look back in the day of Christ and see that his race among them was not run in vain. That the seed he sowed was born fruit in persevering, joy-filled obedience. Notice verses 17 through 18 with me. Paul says, even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. So he reaches for sacrificial imagery from the Old Testament. In the Hebrew Scriptures, the drink offering was not the main sacrifice. It was a smaller libation poured out on top, completing and honoring the primary offering. See, Paul sees the Philippians' faith and obedience as the main sacrifice, the sacrificial offering to God. So his own suffering, even the possibility of martyrdom, would simply be the wine poured out on their suffering. That is how he views his life, gladly expended to adorn and complete the worship of God's people. And remarkably, his tone is not grim but joyful. He says, I am glad and I rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. Suffering for Christ, far from canceling joy, becomes a shared participation in it. Stephen Lawson notes that Paul's imagery here shows how deeply he has embraced the downward path of Christ's own humility. He's willing not merely to labor for the faith, but to be poured out for it. And he invites the Philippians to see this is not a tragedy, but as a privilege. This brings this section to a full circle. The God who works in us, verse 13, calls us to a life without grumbling, shining in a dark world, and rejoicing even when obedience costs us dearly. It is the pattern of Christ, humble and sacrificial. So how do these verses land? How do they land on us? Paul calls to work out your own salvation, and to live without grumbling or disputing means that everyday areas of our lives become the stage where God's grace is put on display. The way you and I respond when things are inconvenient, the way you speak when you're tired of or mistreated, the way you handle disappointment or delay. These either dim or brighten your witness as a child of God in a dark world. Yet none of this is meant to drive you into despair. The same God who commands you is the God who is powerfully at work in you and within you, shaping your desires and supplying your strength. As you yield to Him, you hold fast to the word of life, and your life becomes like Paul's, a joyful offering poured out in worship, not a grim duty carried out in your own power. So having painted this picture, Paul now helps the Philippians to see what this looks like in flesh and blood. He moves from exhortation to example. So instead of merely saying, live this way, he says, in effect, let me show you people who are living this way. And the first is Timothy, a warm-hearted servant whose concern for others, proven character, and genuine interest in the welfare, in their welfare, embody their very mindset Paul has been describing. And that's where he turns to next in verses 19 through 24. We're going to look at a warm-hearted servant, Timothy, verses 19 through 24. Excuse me. I hope in the Lord Jesus to send you Timothy to you soon, so that I too may be cheered by news of you. For I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know Timothy's proven worth. How as a son with a father, he has served me in the gospel. I hope, therefore, to send him just as soon as I see how it will go with me. And I trust in the Lord that surely I myself will come also. So having lifted our eyes to Christ's humility and called us to work our salvation in God-dependent obedience, Paul now turns to show what this looks like in real people. So this section of the chapter is deeply personal. He opens his heart about his desire to see the Philippians. Again, if the Lord grants his release, and lays out how he intends to care for them in the meantime. Since he cannot come himself, he writes, I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you, news of you. See, Timothy is not. Recall, Timothy stood by Paul when the gospel first rang out in Philippi, and now he stands beside him in Rome. So Paul can see their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know, his son with a father, he has served with me in the gospel. A living illustration of the very mindset Paul has been urging throughout this chapter. A genuine concern for others. Shared labor in the gospel. As soon as his own circumstance in the Lord's kindness, he himself will follow. So Paul's of Timothy is anything but vague here. He gives the church concrete reasons why Timothy is the right man to send. He says, for I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. See, that expression, like him, has the idea of being one soul with one another. Timothy is of one mind and heart with Paul. The commentator Dennis Johnson notes that Timothy is not merely loyal to Paul's agenda. He is deeply aligned with Christ's concern for Christ's people. You see, in a world, and sadly a church, where many seek their own interests, Timothy stands out as an embodiment of Philippians 2:4. One who looks not only to his own things, but to the things of others. Timothy is selfless. He doesn't look to just his own things, but he looks to other people. And Paul is saying to the Philippians, everything I have urged you toward in this chapter, humility, other-focused love, gospel partnership, you will see it walking around in Timothy. Paul also reminds them, you know Timothy's proven worth, how as a son with a father he has served with me in the gospel. You see, his character has been tested over time in hard places and under pressure. The language proven worth suggests a metal refined in fire, and Timothy's faithfulness has been demonstrated and not merely assumed. He has not treated ministry as like a platform for himself, but as a shared service with Paul, like a son gladly laboring alongside him or alongside his father. See, Timothy's longing obedience in the same direction through travel, hardship, and unglamorous tasks shows the kind of servant leadership that Paul commends throughout this chapter. Not a self-promotion, but steady, Christ-centered, and people-loving worth. Timothy was selfless, and he loved people. And that's why Paul commended him to go, and he was sent him joyfully. So next, we're going to look at the willing to risk servant of Epaphroditus, verses 25 through 30. I have thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, and the fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need. For he has been longing for you all, and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed he was ill, near to death. But God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but also on me. Lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow, I am the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor, such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. So in verse 25, Paul introduces another trusted servant he intends to send back to Philippi, Epaphroditus. And he was likely a leading figure in the church, therefore entrusted to carry out their financial support to Paul in Rome, and now most likely entrusted to carry this very letter back to them. So Paul piles on titles for him. He calls him my brother, my fellow worker, my fellow soldier, signaling both deep affection and shared mission. See, he's not merely a courier for Paul. He is a co-laborer in the gospel and a comrade in the same battle. As Johnson notes, Paul's language here shows that Epaphroditus stands shoulder to shoulder with the apostle in the hard work and costly conflict of the gospel ministry. Not as an errand runner, but as a partner. So in the context where Paul has just urged the church to look not only to their own interests, but to the interests of others, Epaphroditus becomes another living illustration of that mindset. We also learn that he had become seriously ill while serving Paul. Had distress the church. Paul does not downplay it. He says, was ill near to death. Yet he can say, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. See, the Lord's healing of Epaphroditus was mercy both to man and to the apostle. Another death in the midst of imprisonment, opposition, and hardship would have added a new layer of grief to Paul's already heavy load. See, Paul's willingness to send him back despite his great value to him highlights again this self-forgetful love that seeks the church's comfort above personal convenience. In Epaphroditus, as in Timothy, we see what it looks like when the mind of Christ takes root in ordinary believers. A sacrificial service, a costly risk, and a readiness to be poured out for the good of Christ's people. These people embodied exactly that gospel-fueled thing that Adam talked about this morning. They took risks. They took costly sacrificial risks, and they worked hard. Not for their own benefit, but for the glory of God and the benefit of the church. You see, Epaphroditus was a man willing to hold nothing back. Not even his own life. For the sake of Christ and his church. And the Philippians had sent him to Paul with their support, but his ministry went far beyond delivering a gift to a suffering apostle. You see, he stepped into Paul's hardship, sharing in both the work and the cost of gospel service. He's more than just a courier. He had a deep affection for him. Paul loved Epaphroditus and stands alongside Paul as a family, a co-laborer, and as a comrade. So he nearly died for the work of Christ. Not because he chased danger, because he put Christ's kingdom and church before his own needs. He did not cling to comfort like we do, or self-preservation. He was willing to be spent if it meant strengthening the church. You see, he embodies the very pattern Paul has been presenting to us in chapter 2. Counting others more significant, looking to their interests, and embracing costly service for the sake of Christ. You see, in Epaphroditus, the church sees what it looks like when the mind of Christ takes root in the ordinary believer. Sacrificial love, selflessness, and a readiness to risk for the good of God's people. And that presses in on us, right? You see, we live in a culture that constantly urges us to avoid cost, protect ourselves, and to choose a path of least resistance. But the gospel here calls us to deny ourselves, to take up our cross and follow Jesus. That doesn't mean seeking danger for its own sake, or assuming that poverty and pain are automatically holier. It does mean asking hard questions. Are there comforts or preferences or reputation I am unwilling to lay down if obedience to Christ requires it? Am I prepared, like Epaphroditus, to be inconvenienced, to be stretched, or even endangered if that is what faithfulness in my context looks like? You see, he shows us how easy it is to settle for a safe and comfortable Christianity. Real gospel love, beloved, is costly. When Paul tells the Philippians to receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor, he's teaching the church what kind of people heaven calls honorable. Not those who build platforms or chase recognition, but those who quietly and faithfully and sacrificially serve. He nearly died in the line of duty for Christ. And his story is both a rebuke to our instinct of ease and comfort and an invitation. The church today still needs men and women like him who love Christ enough to spend and be spent for his sake. Are you willing to be spent for his sake? Or are you clinging to comfort? Are you clinging to coast through this life as easy as you can until you meet your Maker? Beloved, the gospel is costly. And we should love Christ enough that we'll be spent for his glory. Paul's closing words about Epaphroditus presses this home. He says, "So receive him and the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me." You see, the terms Paul uses are rich. See, Epaphroditus is their messenger, their apostolos, their sent one, and a minister, a term used elsewhere for priest-like service. Someone who has poured himself out on their behalf. The phrase, risk his life, carries the idea of hazarding or gambling his. He effectively staked his very life to stand in the gap between the Philippians and Paul, completing in person what the church could not do from a distance. So in other words, this is not casual service. It's costly. It's deliberate self-giving. And Paul is clear. Such people are not to be taken for granted. They are to be received in the Lord with all joy and publicly honored. And a letter that has held up Christ's descent and the call to count others more significant than ourselves. You see, Epaphroditus stands as a flesh and blood reminder that ordinary believers, not just apostles, are called to and capable of that kind of sacrificial love. Be an elder. You don't even have to be an apostle to have sacrificial love. Beloved, you have the mind of Christ. You are united to Christ. And you are capable to love like Christ. So the question that Paul leaves us with is not merely, do we admire Epaphroditus, but will you and I learn from him? See, Paul does not elevate him to some unreachable presents him as a brother, an ordinary believer, whose life has been the same Christ they confess. And that is precisely why Paul says, honor such men. Beloved, we are being taught what faithfulness looks like when the mind of Christ moves from confession into costly obedience. And Paul's words press beyond the page into our lives. Because the same gospel that formed Epaphroditus is at work among us. The same call now confronts us as well. The question is no longer about what Epaphroditus did then, but about how the grace of Christ is calling us to live now. Where does faithful obedience require risk? Where does love for Christ and his people demand inconvenience or sacrifice or a quiet perseverance? And whom are we honoring? Not with applause, but with gratitude and an imitation, as they pour out themselves for the sake of the gospel. See, that is where this passage meets us. And that is where we must now consider how the mind of Christ shapes our own obedience, our service, and our willingness to be spent for the good of others and the glory of God. How do we apply this to our lives? So for us, Philippians 2, 12 through 30 means that God's grace goes to work in ordinary, everyday life. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling doesn't mean we try and earn it. It means you and I take it seriously, what God has already worked in you. Do you understand that? He is the one giving both the desire and the power to obey. So there is no room for despair and no room for laziness or slothfulness. That shows up in very practically. And whether we grumble or trust in Him when things are hard, and whether we stir up friction or pursue peace, and whether we quietly hold fast to the word of life when the world around us is crooked and twisted. Beloved, your tone at home, your attitude at work, your response to inconvenience, your words when you are frustrated, those are the places where you either shine as a child of God or blend into the darkness, where you show that you are not of the world. And this passage calls us to take our holiness and unity seriously, not because you and I are strong, but because God Himself is at work in us. And at the same time, Paul refuses to leave this at the level of abstract commands. He gives us Timothy and Epaphroditus as flesh and blood examples. That means we should not only ask, am I obeying these verses? But also, whom has God put in my life who lives like this? And how can I honor and imitate or join them? And Timothy challenges us about our motives in ministry. Do we genuinely care for others' welfare, or do we secretly see in our own interests? And Epaphroditus confronts our love of comfort. Are we willing to risk to be inconvenient, to be poured out for Christ's sake and Christ's people? And together, they press us to move beyond safe spectator Christianity into a costly, joyful service. So a fitting response to this text is to pray, Lord, make me more like Timothy and Epaphroditus, more willing to serve, to sacrifice, because you are at work in me, and Christ has already walked this path before me. Would you pray?